Hello, and welcome to Indie Author Answers, a podcast about writing, editing, storytelling, marketing for self-published and independent authors, plus a lot of off-topic rants about this and that. On this podcast, I will read and critique my unpublished first novel, The Problematic Virtue, one chapter at a time. We'll talk about what worked, what didn't work, and what I could have done better. Follow along from part one at jimheskett.com/part1, part two at jimheskett.com/part2, etc., etc. Now let's get this mother started. Howdy, everyone out there in podcast land. How are you? I'm well, thanks for asking. So you may be wondering why I started off by saying howdy. Well, I've been doing some research for projects, and I've been watching a lot of YouTube videos by this one particular guy, and he starts off every video with, "Hey out there, YouTube," and the videos are short, so you watch 15 of them, and he's like, "Hey out there, YouTube," at the beginning of every video, and it's just really fucking annoying. So I don't want to start off the exact same way for every podcast episode. So I appreciate your patience while I work through this deeply affecting issue. And thanks everyone for your support. Okay, so now that that's out of the way, let's talk about some stuff. I'm currently writing the fourth and probably final volume of the Five Suns Saga, which is called Against the Infinity, which my intention was to wrap up and bring home everything in the series as one final climactic story, but I'm kind of seeing that there's seeds for other things that may happen, so I don't know. I intended it to be the very last one, but we'll see. The same thing kind of happened with my Whistleblower trilogy. Once I got to the end, I was like, you know, I could go back and do a story about this, but so is anything ever really final? That's the take home for this episode of the podcast. Is there such a thing as finality? Let's discuss it. No, let's not. Anyway, so let's do a tip of the week, and this is going to be a very short episode because we have a short passage to read, and so I'll do a tip of the week I've been kind of saving for a little while because I think it's pretty important. I want to make sure that you guys out there in the podcast land get your money's worth. And so here it is. I've read approximately 1.24 million books about writing. In addition to that, I've read somewhere around 4.86 million blog posts about writing, listened to 1.8 million podcasts about writing. There is a wealth of writing information out there for those who seek it. And through all of these bits of knowledge that I've accumulated about writing by doing this kind of research, there's one piece of writing advice that I've always clung to. And I think it's the best piece of writing advice in the world. And if you follow this one piece, I'm starting to sound like one of those banner ads on the side of your browser that's like, learn this one weird trick to curb belly fat. Which, if you're listening to this podcast like 5 years from now, that'll probably make no sense, but that's a topical joke. Anyway. So this one piece of writing advice, I think, encompasses all other pieces of writing advice and is really the only piece of advice you need. And it's by Elmore Leonard, who is one of my favorite writers. Well, he's my favorite dialogue writer for sure. I don't think anyone has ever written dialogue quite like Elmore Leonard. But his writing advice goes like this. If it sounds like writing, rewrite it. Well, what he actually said was, if it sounds like writing, I rewrite it. But to put that in advice form and take out the I, if it sounds like writing, rewrite it. Now, if this was the only piece of writing advice you'd ever heard, that would probably make no sense. Because like Elmore Leonard's 10 Rules of Writing, which I dissected in a blog post on jimheskett.com and something I might talk about in the future, but like those 10 Rules of Writing, I think that this piece of writing advice is subject to interpretation. So if it sounds like writing, rewrite it. Well, what does this mean? So I think that when you're reading a story, in the same way as when you're watching a movie, you want to get lost in the story. You know, when you're at the movie theater and you're engrossed in the movie, you don't even realize that you're at the theater anymore until some dipshit, you know, in the row ahead of you takes out a cell phone and, you know, checks his text and it lights up, and then you realize, oh crap, I'm just totally taken out of the story. Well, so that kind of same cell phone thing can happen when you're reading a book. You get engrossed in the story. You're going along. You're rooting for the characters. You're rooting against the bad guy. You can't wait to find out what happens next. And then something happens that rips you out of the story. And I've talked about this a lot on this podcast because I think there are a lot of examples of things that take you out of the story in The Problematic Virtue. What are some things that can take you out of a story? Well, for indie authors, one thing that we always have to be horribly aware of are typos. You're reading right along, and then there's a misspelled word or a word like where you meant to type deer, D-E-A-R, and it's D-E-E-R. Those kind of things are easy to miss, but readers will absolutely spot that, and then it rips them right out of the story. Or really clunky dialogue, like complete lack of subtext, characters, you know, saying exactly what's on their minds all the time. That kind of thing bothers readers, and they may not be able to pinpoint exactly what's wrong. I mean, a typo, they can clearly pinpoint exactly what's wrong. But if there's something like clunky dialogue or cliched storytelling or too much exposition, they might not even know what's taking them out of the story. But they'll certainly reflect that when they leave you a 1- and 2-star review on Amazon. But as they're going along, if they encounter something that sounds like writing, it's going to take them out of it. And an example of this that I use is in one of the short stories in the first Five Sons book, The Five Sons of Treason. In an early draft, I was writing about a character who's sitting in a bar, and another character comes in, and that first character looks up from his spot at the bar at the other character. And in the original draft, it said, "Coyle regarded Brenner." And then upon revision, I was looking at that, and I looked at the word "regarded." And what I meant to say was Coyle looked up at Brenner. But I think maybe I thought "regarded" sounded a little fancier. You know, that's just the kind of thing that you do in first draft when you're flying along and you're trying to write as many words as possible. Sometimes you just spit stuff out, and then you know you're going to go back later and fix it. And that's fine. But so I was looking at this, and I thought a word like "regarded" sounds like writing. Coyle regarded Brenner. It sounds like writing. Coyle looked up at Brenner is something that sounds more natural. Now, again, I don't want to say that... I'm not trying to say you should never use the word "regarded," because in some cases it's entirely warranted, particularly maybe if you're writing in the POV of a character who's a little more learned, who's a little more well-spoken, and then it might be more fitting to use a word like "regarded" because that's the kind of word that that POV character might actually think or say. And in that case, it's fine. But I was writing about simple characters sitting in a bar having a dialogue. And so "regarded" in that case was too fancy. And so that's something that sounds like writing. Writing that's sloppy can often sound like writing. For example, using adverbs in dialogue tags. "You shouldn't go in there," he said warningly. Oh my god, that's just... I think I threw up in my mouth a little bit when I just said that. So, I mean, first of all, you should never use adverbs in dialogue tags. You should try to avoid adverbs... I wouldn't say altogether, but you should try to avoid adverbs as much as possible in the first place, because they're usually... if you have an adverb, it's because you have a weak verb and you're trying to help out that weak verb. Like, "he walked quickly." Why wouldn't you just say "he ran" or "he sprinted" or "he dashed" or "he darted"? There's so many better verbs that you could use, and you know, you always want to use one word in place of two if it's possible, unless you're writing epic fantasy and then you want to write as fucking many words as possible, because that seems to be whoever writes the longest book wins. And I just now realized that I probably sounded overly critical of epic fantasy, and I don't mean to be. I read epic fantasy. I read George R. R. Martin and Brandon Sanderson and all that shit. So, adverbs sound like writing, and you want to try to remove them when possible, particularly in dialogue tags, he said admonishingly. With the point there being that you should be able to get across the meaning of the dialogue through the dialogue or through action beats around the dialogue. Like if a character narrows his eyes and says, "You shouldn't go in there," we can pretty much understand that the character said it warningly without having to use that word. And then that's also showing instead of telling, because we see the character narrow his eyes or knit his eyebrows together or lower his brow or, you know, do something. Characters do stuff instead of just telling what they're looking like. Anyway, so that's all I have to say about that. If it sounds like writing, rewrite it. That's Elmore Leonard's greatest piece of advice. My greatest piece of writing advice probably is storytelling above all. And that's something that I think I hope to, even though I'm doing a podcast where I critique individual chapters and I get down into nitty gritty and talk about POV and bad grammar and that kind of thing, the overall takeaway I'm hoping that everyone gets from this podcast is that storytelling is the most important thing. 50 Shades of Grey didn't sell a million copies, or a billion, I don't even know. It didn't sell that many copies because the grammar was great. It sold that many copies because people couldn't resist the story. I'm not trying to tell you that E.L. James or whatever her name was is a great storyteller. Please don't think that. Dan Brown is another example. I think that Dan Brown's books are horribly constructed. They're full of cheap tricks, and I think he's a crappy writer, but he's a great storyteller. And so people buy his books in droves, and that's just the way of the world. People want good stories, and everything else is secondary. So now I'll get off my soapbox, and we can talk about The Problematic Virtue, Part 2, Chapter 3. This is a Miguel POV chapter, and it's very short, only 944 words. 3. Miguel. Miguel had spent most of 2001 and 2002 as a dishwasher in an upscale restaurant on Pearl Street in Boulder. He didn't care about the money because most of his income came from other sources, but he liked the sense of accomplishment of an honest day's work, and he needed the W-2 for tax purposes. He liked the simplicity and zen of washing dishes. To take something impure and make it pure, a wrong to right. Dirty plates, glasses, and bowls stack up, load them into the tray, pass them through, take the clean ones and run them out to their respective clean dish stations. Also, he preferred to operate under the radar, and no one paid much attention to the dishwasher. The day after the party when he'd kicked Tyson out of his house, Wiles confronted Miguel about what happened at the bridge. The conversation didn't end well, and Miguel and Wiles terminated their association with each other after that, at least their direct association. They still did business together, but always through other people. Miguel drifted away from Brian, too. The shame of what he'd seen at the bridge, what he hadn't told Maria, Theo, or anyone else, the secret he intended to lock away forever, overwhelmed him and he couldn't look Brian in the eyes after that. After the incidents, first cracking a beer bottle over Ray's head, and then the one at the bridge a few days later, Miguel waited for Ray to retaliate. He had promised retribution at the bridge, but Ray Aguilar was patient. Ray might let years pass by. After a quiet period, Miguel decided that he needed to go out and find Ray and those other thugs collectively known as the Northside Mafia and do something about it. This had been his other main activity of the last 2 years. One by one, he and Theo, who rarely asked questions about their excursions, tracked down the men involved in Commerce City and eliminated any they found. Most of the time they had no trouble because those they silenced were miscreants that no one would mourn. Finding Ray and his last remaining close associates turned out to be not as cut and dried. Then, in December of 2002, a tip led them to CJ Body Shop, a mechanic who had supposedly been working on Ray's car for several days. A mutual friend had seen the yellow Mustang parked out front, and so Theo and Miguel stopped at a sandwich shop across the street for lunch. They ordered their food and took their seats at the restaurant patio. "I thought you was going to shit your pants," Theo said as he offered a bag of chips to Miguel. "Who would have thought that black guy was going to pull a baseball bat?" While trying to find Ray, Miguel discovered that he'd alienated many former allies because of what had happened at the bridge. The last house they had visited had been quite inhospitable. "You know I don't like to run," Miguel said. Next time I'm bringing something with us, knife or bat or something. I'm not making that mistake again. Theo laughed through a mouthful of food. The look on your face. I ain't never seen you look like that before. You just... Theo stopped mid-sentence, pointing at a Ford Mustang as it exited the garage of the mechanic. Wait. Shit, that's the car right there. Miguel dropped his sandwich and grabbed his keys. Let's just wait until we see Ray. A few moments later, Ray emerged from the mechanic's office and walked towards the car. Miguel bolted from the table, and Theo followed to the truck, eager not to let Ray out of their sight. By the time they drove away from the sandwich shop, the Mustang had gone on through the light and then left at the next street. When their light turned green, Miguel drove to the same intersection, but proceeded straight instead of turning to follow. "What are you doing? We're going to lose him," Theo said. "Don't worry," Miguel said. "He's got to be getting on the highway." Miguel drove through the next light and glanced left. As he suspected, the Mustang had turned right and was now traveling parallel, one street over. The current street dead-ended at the highway's on-ramp. As they reached the end, the yellow car crossed in front of them. "I knew it," Miguel said. "Not too close," Theo said. "This is some video game shit right here. He'll know your truck, right?" "Don't worry about it. I know what I'm doing." "You done this before?" Theo said. Miguel laughed. "Nope, but I play tons of video games. I got this covered." Miguel tailed the car onto the highway with the Mustang 50 feet ahead of them. He took care to keep a reasonable distance between them for several minutes and kept a watchful eye on the Mustang's rear view to see if Ray's eyes would meet his. They never did. When they exited the highway and started navigating through side streets, a couple of turns later, Miguel realized where they were going. "Ah, shit," he said. "I know where he's headed. We're going to Ray's parents' house." "For real?" "Can you believe the stones on this guy? Staying at his parents' crib, knowing half the city of Denver got beef with him? Damn, I would have never thought to look here." "What do we do now?" Theo said. "I ain't got a piece or anything on me." "We can't run up on him just yet. We need to think this through. All we got to do now is come up with a plan and wait." So, let's talk about what we've read, right? I mean, that's what we're here to do, I would think. Anyway, let's talk about it. So here we have Miguel's POV, and the last time we saw Miguel, I believe, the last thing that had happened was he was trying to comfort Maria after she and Ray had broken up. And if you, here's a little recap of Miguel's storyline in case you forgot. Miguel started out and he went up to a party where Ray was. Ray was being all, he was all drunk and being a dick about Maria. Miguel cracked a bottle over his head. Then we have this, the thing that we still don't know exactly what happened at the bridge. Brian was there. He asked Miguel to come help him. Miguel showed up. Things went bad. Then Brian's at the party. Miguel shows up. Miguel kicks Tyson out of the house. Then Miguel comes home from work, and he's comforting his sister, who's bipolar. And that's pretty much, if I'm not forgetting anything, I think that's pretty much all Miguel's storyline so far. So what we have here in this Miguel chapter, and I don't know if I mentioned this last time or not, but originally, so this is a book in four parts. We've already read part one, and we're halfway through part two. Originally, part two didn't exist. It skipped from part one in the year 2000 to part three in the year 2003, and then I realized that I needed some connective tissue, or at least I thought that I, at the time, I thought that I needed some connective tissue between part one and part two to explain what all of these characters had been doing for those 3 years that the book skipped over. So I initially wrote like six or eight chapters in part two that were all short, and they're all basically summaries. They're like, this character did this, and then this happened, and then this happened, and blah, blah, blah. There was no showing. It was all telling. And as you can see from this chapter, that a lot of that telling maintained intact, because basically the first half of this chapter, everything until that leads up to where they're at the body shop, is just all telling. It's all summary about what Miguel's been up to for 2001 and 2002. And the point I'm trying to make with that is that essentially none of that is necessary. I really could have gotten most of that across in dialogue or through little bits of exposition that were peppered throughout the rest of the book. I mean, this first paragraph where it talks about how he's a dishwasher and how he likes the simplicity and zen of washing dishes. This part, I think, is actually pretty decent because it really paints a good picture of Miguel. And as I mentioned before, unanimously, my beta readers all said that Miguel was their favorite character. And this is the kind of thing of why people like Miguel, because he's a dishwasher and he likes it and he finds zen simplicity of taking something impure and make it pure. Like, that's kind of an interesting characterization. That's way better than the characterization of Brian being a collector of accents, if you remember from way back. That's just kind of a weird quirk that doesn't really add anything to him. But this thing of Miguel liking to wash dishes, now that's interesting characterization. And also the mention that he needed the W-2 for tax purposes, which is something I stole from an episode of The Sopranos. My little wink and a nod to The Sopranos there. And then in the second paragraph, we have this summary of the day after the party when he'd kicked Tyson out of his house, Wiles confronted Miguel about what happened at the bridge. So, this sounds really interesting. This sounds like something we would have liked to have known about, something we would have liked to have seen shown instead of just told to us. But the problem with that is I couldn't show it. I probably couldn't have shown it because, as we know, what happened at the bridge is essentially the main mystery of the entire book. And there's even a reference to it here at the end of this paragraph. The shame of what he'd seen at the bridge, what he hadn't told Maria, Theo, or anyone else. And here it is. The secret he intended to lock away forever. So if you're a reader and you are engaged with the story, by this point you're dying to know what happened at the bridge. I mean, I wouldn't assume that readers are actually engaged with the story because there's so many different things going on. It's too hard to keep track of each character's arc and each character's desires. If you want a good exercise in too many characters, I would highly recommend reading all of George R.R. Martin's A Song of Ice and Fire. And bear with me a second while I go on this tangent. The first three books in the Song of Ice and Fire series are great. They are amazing. See, what's the first one? Game of Thrones. And then the second one is A Feast for Crows. Or is that the fourth one? I don't even remember. Anyway, I'm not going to try to figure it out. So the first three books, A Storm of Swords, A Feast for Crows, I think. And I can't remember. That's not right. Anyway, forget it. I'm going to move on. The first three books in that series are amazing. They have a huge cast, dozens and dozens of characters, but everything feels like it's moving toward the same direction. You know who, because each character gets a POV chapter, and those chapters are so long, you spend enough time with the character that you get invested. And then, for a lesson in how that can go wrong, books 4 and 5 in the series completely go off the rails. Particularly book 5. Book 4, I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of it. Book 4 is just boring. Very little happens in that entire book. The ending is kind of exciting because stuff actually happens, but it's just boring. But then in book 5, George R. R. Martin loses his mind, and I wrote a blog post on Jameska.com about this, about how I think that George R. R. Martin has lost his mind with book 5, and I'm hoping that with book 6, The Winds of Winter, I'm hoping that it actually, he gets his shit back together. But book 5 has so many characters, and the plot thrusts of the main characters, you know, namely the Stark family, the Lannister family, the Targaryens, it's all so drifted off into nothingness that it makes no sense at all anymore. So I know that asking you to go read like 5,000 pages of of a book series for a storytelling lesson is probably a lot, but if you've already read the books, you probably know what I'm talking about. How the storytelling has just veered off into too many directions, and what made the books great at the beginning of the series is now completely lost. So anyway, back to the problematic virtue. So Miguel has lost touch with Brian. And then there's some little recap here. The incidents, cracking a beer bottle over Ray's head, then what happened at the bridge. So Miguel's waiting for Ray to retaliate. Ray hasn't done anything about what happened at the bridge yet. Whatever it was that happened at the bridge, which we still don't know. Rey hasn't done anything yet. But we do know that it says he had promised retribution, but Rey Aguilar was patient. So this is the kind of thing that I did for convenience, because I need to have Miguel and Rey have a standoff, but I also need to have 3 years pass between part one and part three. So I included this thing that Rey Aguilar being patient. And this is an example of bending the story to fix a logic problem, because it seems kind of strange that if Rey is genuinely pissed off about whatever terrible thing happened at the bridge, that he would retaliate against Miguel immediately. You'd think, right? He cracked a bottle over Rey's head, and then he pissed him off at the bridge. But Rey's going to let years go by before doing anything about it? That seems kind of strange. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, as I was talking about earlier, about something that sounds like writing. This is the kind of strange story logic that sounds like writing and is going to pull a reader out of the story. They'd be like, well, why, if Rey's such a badass and he's so violent, why is he going to let Miguel live and be a free man for years? Anyway, so then we have another strange thing where it says, after a quiet period, Miguel decided he needed to go out and find Rey and those other thugs. So why did Miguel let time pass? That's not explained either. But we know that for 2 years, for 2001 and 2002, he and Theo have been tracking down the men involved in Commerce City, which is a synonym for the bridge, and eliminating them. So they've been killing these gangbangers. And then we have a word that's definitely not in Miguel's POV. They had no trouble because those they silenced were miscreants that no one would mourn. Given what we know about Miguel, the word miscreants probably doesn't sound like it's in his POV. So then we finally get out of the summary section and into a real scene, because it's December of 2002 and they're at this body shop where they're looking at Rey's car. Or they're not looking at Rey's car, but they think that Rey's car had been there because they got a tip, like they're detectives, that Rey is there and he's getting his car worked on. And we have this bit of dialogue, which is sort of another kind of summary, but it's a little bit better because it's through dialogue where Theo says, thought you're going to shit your pants. This guy pulled a baseball bat. And then we still have some summary, which isn't really necessary. Again, sort of restating the fact that they've been tracking down these guys while trying to find Rey. Miguel had discovered he'd alienated former allies because of what happened at the bridge. The last house had been quite inhospitable. So then they're still talking. Theo says, that look in your face, I've never seen you look like that before. Theo stopped mid-sentence, pointing at a Ford Mustang as it exited the garage of the mechanic. Wait, that's the car right there. Which, that's kind of a bit of overwriting, because if he's pointing at the garage of the mechanic, that's the car right there isn't really necessary. So then Rey comes out, he gets in his Mustang, and then we have a car chase. And I do like the car chase. For some reason, I've included them in most of my books. I think I've just grown up with car chase movies so much that I really like them, even though car chases in general don't work as well in fiction. But I still have a great love of car chases. I've included them. There's one in Reagan's Ashes. There's one in the Whistleblower book. There's at least one in the Whistleblower books. I think there are two over the course of the trilogy. Anyway, moving on. You don't care. So they got this car chase. And then Miguel's never done this before. You know, Theo's like, this is some video game shit right here. He'll know your truck, right? And then Miguel laughs. He's like, nope, I play a ton of video games. I got this covered. So here's a little moment of levity, which I've learned over the course of writing, that you can't be serious all the time in your fiction. It gets too intense. Now, a lot of authors combat this by having snarky characters. Having, you know, a protagonist who's funny is a great way to make them sympathetic. And also, it's good if you insert a little bit of levity in with your seriousness. Like, my wife and I have been watching this show called American Crime, and it's really good, but it's so, so serious. It's about this guy who gets killed, and then it's essentially all about the fallout that happens to the families, the family of the victim, the family of the murderer, and it's just a lot of people being really intense and really serious, and there's no levity in the show. And, like, it's really well made, and I enjoy watching it, but, like, I can't watch two episodes in a row. You know, I need to, like, watch it and then watch an episode of Louie or Silicon Valley or something to, like, decompress after, because it's so freaking serious. So the moral of that story is you can't lead readers too far down the rabbit hole with one single emotion for too long, or else you turn them off. So I'm not saying that there's a great deal of levity in this book, but at least there are some emotional switches as opposed to American Crime. Anyway, so they're tailing the car, and then Miguel figures out where they're going. They're going to Ray's parents' house, which is supposed to be kind of a plot twist because they've been looking all over the city, all over Denver, for Ray, and then it turns out that he's been hiding at his parents' crib the whole time. And when I read these kind of this kind of slang in here, it sort of makes me cringe because I don't know if a reader would buy it. Lines like, staying in his parents' crib knowing half the city of Denver got beef with him? I just don't know if that's believable. I mean, if you want to have a character who speaks in a real slang, you really have to sell it. And I don't know if I sell it here with Miguel. And then you end up with stuff like, what is James Dashner's book, The Maze Runner? Which I liked. I thought he used some kind of Dan Brown dirty tricks that I didn't like inserting cliffhangers at the end of chapters just to have cliffhangers at the end of chapters. I mean, I've talked about cliffhangers at the end of chapters and that they should serve a purpose at least, other than to make you read on, but he would just end a chapter wherever there was a cliffhanger. But that, I wasn't trying to get off on a tangent about James Dashner, but the point I was trying to make is that in that book, there's slang, but they only really use slang to replace swear words because it's a YA book and you can't really get away with having swearing in a YA book unless you're John Green. So in this book, instead of shit, they say clunk. And it's just stuff like that. Like, when the purpose of slang is so deliberate to cover up bad words, like, that's the kind of thing that pulls you out of a story, too. So this slang, using words like crib and beef, it does kind of pull you out of the story. And I don't know if I've sold Miguel well enough for a reader to buy it. Anyway, so this chapter does end on a cliffhanger of sorts that I think works pretty well. Because the last line, you know, here is, all we got to do now is come up with a plan and wait. So it's sort of a cliffhanger because you're thinking, well, what's this plan? What are they going to do? What's going to happen when they find Ray? But the chapter still has a beginning, middle, and end in a way, kind of. I mean, the end is the climax of the chapter, the conclusion of this chapter is that they find out where Ray lives. And then the teaser that leads you on is that they're not done. Now that they found him, they have to do something about it. So that should lead you on into the next chapter. Even though, because I use all these multiple POVs, it's going to be like 5 or 6 chapters before we get back to Miguel's POV. Actually, maybe it's not that many. Maybe just 2 more. And I can tell you this, the next Miguel chapter is very exciting. It's one of the best chapters in the book, and I think I do a pretty good job with it. It's a very action-packed, suspenseful chapter. And we do get some resolution on part of Miguel's storyline. So anyway, that's all I have to say about that. I intended for this episode to be really short, but I think I rambled on about all kinds of crap anyway. So I appreciate your patience. Thanks for listening. I love you guys, and I will see you next week. Well, that's it for this week's episode. Please rate and review us on iTunes, Stitcher, and wherever else you found us. Check out the show at indieauthoranswers.com. Also, check out jimheskett.com and sign up for the email list to get notified of new episodes and freebie goodies. Like the Indie Author Answers Facebook page and follow us on Twitter at indieanswers. I appreciate you spending your time with me. Now go out there and write. Do it. Jim says so.